how do we tell if something is sort of a one-off outlier, if it's not something to take seriously? How do we tell if something's forming a new trend when we're looking at sort of things we find on the docket? And I have a couple things to share with you today as a show and tell part of my presentation, things I've that have come across that are worth thinking about what they mean and whether they're going to start to affect things in the future. The first one was on April 1st, a case called Daniel Crist versus Texas Department of Transportation showed up on the orders list. And I didn't notice it the day it came out, but a friend pointed out to me pretty quickly, and there was more talk about it. What you see on the docket page is that the petition was granted the same day that briefs on the merits were requested. I think in one of the emails I received about this asked, is this an April Fool's joke? Because, of course, all good things are announced on April 1st, or is this a mistake of some kind? And there was really not much information about it. And then about a month later, Michelle Cassidy, who's now at Law 360, published a very long and interesting article about titled Texas Supreme Court Test Change to Bizarre Brief Process. It may not be as bizarre to us who live in it, but I think we can agree it has some strange features. And this article has a lot of content in it that's interesting because she was able to talk to two different justices, both Justice Hecht and Justice Young. And, you know, that Justice Hecht noted that this is the analogy to the U.S. Supreme Court practice, that they grant before asking for briefs. And the article described this as testing the waters, and I think they quoted Justice Hecht colorfully saying it's a toe-in-the-water kind of thing. The word bizarre in the title is in quotes because Justice Young used that word to describe the process. But I think the feature that he highlights in this article is one that I've talked about before that I do think is a strange feature, is that the briefs on the merits still have to focus on the question of whether the court should grant or not. So the respondent has incentives not to make the case interesting, and the petitioner has incentives that are also sort of focused on the importance of the case rather than the correct doctrinal result that might apply to future cases. In the article, Justice Hecht said he wouldn't name names, but that some of his colleagues were perfectly happy with the current system. And so there's a little bit of sense that there's a conversation happening inside the court. Of course, this might lead to efficiencies, but I think the efficiency really comes from the court granting fewer briefing requests, not from the timing of when the briefing requests are made. I mean, the timing affects what the briefs on the merits say. Are the briefs about the merits? Are they about granting? We'll talk about this again in a second. I did tell you it's a long article. But one of the things the article talked about is there's conversation maybe the court should lengthen the PFRs so that you can address more things in the PFR if they're going to grant off of that. So there's some different discussions here about different amounts of length that might be available. The U.S. Supreme Court's at 9,000 words. We're currently at 4,500 words. There's a lot of room to work with there. And there's sort of this question of, is this an experiment? Is the court looking for input? Is this not a conscious pilot program? So we don't know too much. We have the sense that it's not really an experiment, but it's also not really a system that's in place yet. I think it's clear they want more input from us, and I think we'll hear more about it in the conference and a chance to talk to people about what it would mean to you. What I would notice is this has happened before. When I was at the SG's office, the case N. Ray Michael Fisher came through, and we saw the court grant review off the petition. I thought that was interesting. That didn't happen in a lot of our cases, although we thought our cases were very important. That one got accelerated treatment. And in preparing for this talk, I ran back through the numbers as far back as my database goes, and I saw that this happened sometimes, you know, 6-8 times a term when I was clerking, around 99 or 2000. So this had happened before, but it did stop, and then it didn't happen again until this April. The other interesting thing is that it has not happened again. So the courts denied 83 petitions that have had a response without, at that stage. It's made 22 requests for full briefing, issued one sort of strange per curiam, but it hasn't taken the step yet of granting another case without requesting briefs. So it'll be interesting to see if this is an experiment of sort of size one, or if there are more of these that come along, or the kinds of factors that might go into deciding whether a particular case gets treated like this. The other thing at the show and tell that's happened that I've not seen before is joint authors of opinions. And this one is from early this year. Justice Blacklock and Justice Young delivered the opinion of the court. I think this might have been Justice Young's first signed opinion. I haven't seen a dual opinion like this before. But on the theme of these things you notice starting to come around, we had another one in May. And this one is, the strangest part of this one is not that it's jointly authored, actually. The strangest part of this opinion was that Justice Blacklock both was the lead author and authored part of the opinion, and then also filed an opinion dissenting to part of that same opinion.